This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We begin tonight with the states of emergency in the Northeast at this hour as severe thunderstorms and flash flooding slam New York City, Philadelphia, Washington, D.C., New York, and New Jersey tonight, declaring emergencies. Drivers rescued from their cars on expressways. The rain falling at a rate of up to 3 inches an hour, flooding sweeping streets and highways, rivers and creeks rising quickly, storm drains unable to keep up.
Japan and South Korea reel from record-breaking heat. South Korea has experienced a record-breaking streak of tropical nights, while Japan saw its hottest day on record on Thursday. According to The Guardian, July 31st, on Thursday, South Korea's meteorological office said the country had experienced a record-breaking streak of tropical nights for 22 consecutive days this month. A day earlier, Japan saw its hottest day on record, with the mercury reaching 41.2 C, 106 F. As hospitals across the country were inundated with people who had fallen ill as a result of the heat wave, overnight temperatures in Seoul stayed above 25 C, 77 F, for 22 consecutive days in July, meteorological officials said, the longest period since modern weather records were first kept in 1907.
That was ABC News with David Muir, July 31st, followed by a reading from the Guardian newspaper the same day. It's almost as though extreme heat and heavy rains amplify one another. As we hear in a new conversation with guest Jan Umsonst in Germany, that is exactly what is happening. Jan explains why with new science. He writes about the relationships between extreme precipitation events and neighboring heat waves. When water condenses into ice and water in the atmosphere, the original energy used to evaporate that water is returned as heat in the upper atmosphere, or at least at cloud level. This heat then strengthens nearby heat waves. Conversely, heat waves can increase chances of extreme precipitation events in low-pressure areas bordering the heat highs, he says. In an email, I asked Jan why giant waves of heat and extreme rain hover over big regions as they are right now, often following one another like a train. In fact, it is called a wave train, and in a few minutes we discuss that in our interview. Jan wrote in a personal email to me, large-scale ocean fronts intensify, which support low-pressure systems that reinforce high-pressure systems and blocking patterns, which then produce wave guides, triggering continental heat waves and flooding in the extratropics. The main principle is simple. Local feedbacks interact with regional feedbacks, supported by synoptic teleconnections that create air mass transports or induce persistent wave trains in the jets, all culminating in the intensification of single regional to continental events, end quote from Jan. And unlike many other climate weather feedbacks, we don't know what new limits might be for these extreme amplifications of both heat and precipitation. That assumes there are limits. Jan cites a breaking paper published July 7, 2025, finding an accelerating increase in the duration of heat waves under global warming. That study was led by Christian Martinez Villalobos from the Universidad Adolfo Ibanez in Santiago, Chile. These scientists find, quote, that the non-linearity results in acceleration of the rate of increase with warming, that is, each increment of regional time-averaged warming increases the characteristic duration scale of long heat waves more than the previous increment. This is very serious. The most deadly and damaging impacts of climate change, heat and extreme precipitation, do not increase evenly as Earth warms. Every fraction of a degree of added heat ratchets up the extremes even more. Former NASA Goddard director James Hansen also emphasized the nonlinear relationship between global temperature increase and the severity of climate impacts. He says global warming is accelerating.
Some gas, speed it all up.
So maybe you have not spent the last 20 years trying to understand how the world weather system works. I know, we're all busy. You just wonder what the heck broke and why is life harder? Why are so many days unbearable and insurance costs higher than the floodwaters? We want to know why and what to expect. Is it going to be safe to live here? Should my family get ready or get ready to move out on short notice? The information we need was never taught in school. Politicians don't get it, and most journalists don't either. The truth is, even the best climate models did not predict this chaotic new reality we experience. Every week, even during the summer doldrums of publishing, startling new science is breaking with bad news about the climate. Yes, it is worse than we thought. Jan Umsonst says people will only believe it when we experience enough discomfort to force change upon us. That's a bit bleak, but it may be true. As I speak, flocks of lightning around my home have ignited dozens of fires in the tinder-dry bush of British Columbia. It is 96 degrees Fahrenheit over 35 C in the shade outside my door. The lawn is brown, with only a teaspoon of rain in the last month or more. It has already been another year of abnormal wildfires in Canada, with smoke adding to the heat waves across the eastern U.S. and dimly visible as far away as Europe. The area burned so far in northern Canadian forests is already twice what was previously normal.
No relief in sight, this never-ending heat wave burning up the night. Streets are like an oven, feel the concrete turn. Melting in the sunshine, can't escape the burn. Every breath I take is like a fire in my lungs. Feels like I'm walking through an inferno. It stings and stuns, mirage plays tricks on me. Oasis just a dream, oasis just a dream.
A paper published May 30, 2025 in PNAS has the title Unprecedentedly High Global Forest Disturbance Due to Fire in 2023 and 2024. Canadian system scientist Paul Beckwith has an explainer video just out on that on his YouTube channel. So the rise of the age of fire is global and now includes 2025. In the distance, I hear helicopters in the hills, dumping water buckets on flaming bush. We check our escape bags again tonight. In the States, it's a different demon right at the moment in the East. After thousands of flash flood warnings over the past month, and sadly many deaths, it's all on again, with unbelievable sudden downpours plaguing small towns and big cities. Friends, I hope humans don't take much longer, that we don't deny the crashing blows until it is far too late. Let's not wait until we lose our homes, our friends, our lives. It is time for change, real climate action. A listener passed on a Facebook post by Jan Umsonst. He is not a scientist, but describes himself as an Earth system nerd. After 20 years of watching, digging, and taking notes, Jan describes this ongoing quest to know why. In his Facebook feed, he talks about it and keeps pumping information out there for all of us. Here, at the end of a tumultuous July, is our conversation, the first time we ever spoke.
Radio EcoShock.
Well, I'm so glad we really connected because I've been admiring your work and following it. Usually when one of your posts takes me about half an hour of digging to follow up your science and see what you're doing.
I try to track the system. Actually, I do it since 20 years. I'm learning Earth, and I'm highly fascinated. It's a really, it's a beautiful system, but has a lot of power. And we underestimated Earth, actually. It's a water planet. Never heat up a water planet fast. First rule in the universe, never do it.
How did you get started in this?
Me? Was 2007, I was in Istanbul. I'm more like a anarchist hippie type punk person. And I heard that the oceans are acidifying. I was like, what? Oceans are acidifying? They are big. And I thought, okay, what's going on? So since then, I wanted to understand what is changing in the Earth system. And I wanted to take part in the resistance in a way. And I came to the idea that I have the only method I have is writing and knowledge. So because I have no money, I have no higher education or something like that. So I started learning and I started to write a book on Earth and the changes. And I called it The Planet of the Crazy Apes, like sci-fi story. But for that, I needed to model the whole Earth system till 2167. So I needed to dig in all this science to be able to change the Earth system accordingly to our impact. And I think after the first week, I started to read studies and I realized, oh, 7 pages, not long, 8 pages, okay. So since then, I read studies. That's how I learn. And studies are nice. It's very compact, the knowledge, and they're actually mostly they're nicely written. And most studies you can, you know what means easily digest, but if you learn the terminology, with time you can really easy read them. And with time, I've stumbled upon more subject in the Earth system. This system is important. What does that change? Or what does this mean? So it got more and more topics. And with time, I started to connect more and more changes accordingly to the scientific discussion. So in the beginning, I read single papers. And then I switched to reading the whole discussions. So otherwise, you are not able to understand the positions inside the discussions. And you need to understand the mechanics of the system to be able to understand how systems behave or how they will behave in the future. And you need the mechanics to be understand how one system change interconnects with other changes. So you can make all these interconnectors alike. And with time, you get like an Earth system model in your head.
Well, I've been doing interviews for about 20 years with scientists, but I have to admit, as I get older, I'm not maintaining a memory of what everyone said. I wish I had one of those memories where every word is still recorded. But what I do retain is sort of overview conclusions about what they had to say and where this fits together. And I find now that they are fitting together better, that I'm getting a better overview of some subjects, even though I can't cite the exact paper that it came from. I have to look that up all over again. I don't know how you work. How do you work? You seem to have quite a flow of new science, but you don't stick only to new science. You follow chains down and will come up with something important from 2020.
The point is, you are not in time. You don't get aware of all these papers. Sometimes you need 2 or 3 years till you find a paper that was important that you missed. So you cannot go just for the newest papers. It's not possible. Often it's deep inside the discussion. So it's aspects of single systems or how systems interconnect or how they recently changed. So you have lots of subjects, a lot of change that are discussed, and you have to go if you get aware of the subject, you have to dig into it. That's how I work. I normally work with citations. I go up and down the timeline, so I find new papers, new aspects via citations normally. Actually, it's a very good method to learn and to research. Just go by the citations of the single papers. With time, you follow more and more discussions. And if you went deep inside a single discussion, you can follow it by the abstracts. So in the past, I read mostly all studies. And now with time, I switched more and more to read the abstracts as I only follow like a follow-up of a discussion. Yeah? It's fascinating. For me, it's like... we underestimated what we triggered in the system. And now models are wrong. It's obvious models they can model single changes. They're very good at these kind of things. But how the whole system reacts, they cannot model anymore. It's too complex and you need too many processes simulated down to small scales. And models use a lot of parameterizations to reduce computational power, but these parametrizations makes it impossible for models to simulate these mutual amplification processes that take now over, and they normally function over small scales. So slowly, slowly, the whole thing leaves the model range now. And it's as fascinating as it's frightening, actually.
You know, there's a big debate in AI about whether AI can actually originate anything, because it's trained on all the past data, on all the past sayings and everything that people have written. But the new thing, the new combination is not in there. And I wonder if this applies also to some degree to climate science and models, as you were just discussing, because the models originally were based on sort of normal weather, if you will, or weather over the last few decades by comparison. But we've seen shocking new things that were never in the record, and it seems like those are the things that models most can't pick up.
Mm-hmm. What you see now is weather is becoming climate. In the past, we saw like 30 years, weather becomes climate. But now we have single weather events that reach magnitudes and intensities that they have a longer lasting impact on the climate system, also in terms of warming. And these weather extremes we observe now, which increase much faster than model, be it extreme flooding, for example, extreme heat waves, extreme drought, or the rapid intensification of hurricanes and stuff like that, it increases all much faster than we saw, and also changes in sea ice, like the Antarctic, for example, or the expansion and intensification of marine heat waves, all happens much faster than modeled. And all these changes, they are driven by mechanics that mutual amplify over small scales and short temporal scales, so short spectral scales. So like, for example, take a heat wave. Yeah, heat wave, they get really hot. You need soil moisture to drop below critical levels. So if you have very low soil moisture, you have no evaporation anymore. And evaporation of water cools down the atmosphere. So if this is not anymore the case, you get higher surface temperatures. Okay, so you get a drier, hotter heat wave. But then comes the next aspect. What we observe now, we get now these areas with large intensified floodings. And these large areas where you have this extreme convection, they produce hot upper air. Because condensation that produces rain releases energy into the atmosphere, and this hot upper air that's produced by these convective systems or regions where you have a lot of precipitation, it comes down over the heat waves. And these heat waves are then heated up even more by hot upper air descending inside these high pressure systems. And like, for example, the first event we had was Lytton, Canada, 2021 was it? West Canada, West Coast, and Lytton inside the Canadian forest, southern part, more near the US border, reached close to 50 degrees. And 50 degrees was not forecasted, predicted, even close in this area. It was about 4 or 5 degrees above normal, these temperatures. And the reason was a strong convection in the Western Pacific, which produced hot upper air that were also coming down in this heat wave. And it magnified it. And now we have the case that we have more and more of these different amplification processes contributing to the single extreme events. That's the reason they're called compound events, where many, many single factors contribute to a single event. And they reach now magnitudes and scales and intensities we did not thought possible before. And these amplifications, for example, between low and high pressure systems, they did not play any role in meteorology or atmospheric physics, because they were only to a minor degree important in a climate system that had not so much energy. But now, with the climate system gearing up to higher levels, these couplings between low pressure and high pressure systems, they intensify. And they can produce then higher rates of precipitation on one side and heat waves that heat up more fast. And this is not inside the models, because models, they don't simulate weather. They don't, like, for example, big Earth system models, they are non-convective models. But you need to be able to simulate all these intensifications, you need convection. That starts. You need soil moisture down to meters depth, not just the surface. Models also don't simulate soils down to the deeper layers, only the surface, like a slab surface to simulate. So you have all these amplification processes. Models were not designed to simulate, because they also they don't simulate the small time steps you need for convective systems to build up, stuff like this, or for heat waves to build up. So models are not able to simulate all these processes that lead now to these insane events we have now. So climate models come now to their, it's like the dead end, climate models in a way. We need quantum computers to gain the computational power to enable models to calculate all these processes down to small scales and on short temporal scales, so short time scales, like hours, best an hour, you know. It's really frightening what the system is already producing at 1.5 degrees of warming. So it's insane what we have now. You were interested in all these heat waves in the North Africa and Middle East, which reach now insane intensities. That's also one aspect of it.
Yes, it's true that a model may be able to present what the annual precipitation would be expected to be, or even what the monthly precipitation would be. But if that all comes down in 2 hours, that's a very different event. That's a huge, fast flood and people dying. So the model was not necessarily wrong, but it didn't work.
Yeah, the models are, in a sense, they are not wrong, but they don't simulate the scales you need to track these extreme events that come down, like Beijing. We had now Beijing. We had in 1 week, they had the rain for 1 year. In 1 week, it came down. In two days, they had this maximum precipitation. And so you get precipitation worth of 1 year rainfall coming down in 2 days. And they have a lot of precipitation in China, because near to the tropics, or subtropics. So they reach about, I thought, 700 millimeters was it in a week.
Yes, northern China, they've had their worst flood in 140 years of keeping records was in 2023, and that also flooded parts of Beijing. They had another one in 2024, and now this one, we don't know how bad it will be statistically, but it's quite bad. They lost power to about 180 villages, and there were parts of Beijing suburbs that were flooded, and 30 people were just killed in an old age facility when the floodwaters invaded it and they couldn't get them out in time. So very serious matters happening there. Now, in an email, I talked to you, and I think I also posted about this to you on your Facebook feed, which is excellent, by the way, about how we have these waves where, say, the central U.S. is baking in a heat wave, but the western U.S. is actually a bit colder than normal and rainy. So it depends sort of on which side of the jet stream you find yourself. And you cited a paper, and I just want to read a little bit from that paper. The paper was Accelerating Increase in the Duration of Heat Waves During Global Warming. It was published July 7th, 2025. Martinez Villalobos was the lead author for that. And just one sentence from that. We find that the non-linearity results in acceleration of the rate increase with warming, that is, each increment of regional time-averaged warming increases the characteristic duration scale of long heat waves more than the previous increment. So if it goes up 0.1 of a degree, that makes the heat wave just a little bit longer. And that seems like a very worrying sort of feedback. It's not linear. It's much more than that.
I mean, what is interesting, I'm occupied now since some 20 years with this discussion. And in the beginning, like I started in 2007 to learn Earth, that Earth is a highly non-linear system was clear at that time. And there were not many papers addressing the non-linearity of the system. And it was more like then in the late 20s till like 21, 22, the non-linearity was like, it had like a shadow life in climate science. And now it comes up again because it can't not deny it anymore that the climate system of Earth is highly non-linear. And each increase of temperature we will get in the future will lead to a much larger increase in extremes or subsystem changes. And that's the most important part, that the Earth system is consists out of a wide variety of subsystems that operate from the local to the planetary. And these subsystems, they are in many, many cases highly dynamic. Subsystem can be, for example, an ocean region that builds up heat waves. So it's just a mixed upper mixed layer heats up during summer. It can happen very fast. So a large part of an ocean surface can heat up very fast. So it's a highly dynamic system, the ocean surface. Then you have like snow cover. Snow cover can very fast change in a season. You have, for example, sea ice, areas with sea ice that expand in one season, but other areas, they really decline drastically. They're going to have very fast, strong shifts in sea ice. Another example. Then you can have like moisture transport in the atmosphere. In one sector, for 1, 2, 3 days, it can massively increase and pump extreme levels of moisture into a system, which amplify their strong convection and stuff like this and flooding. But in the neighboring region, it intensifies massively a heat wave just per system for a week. And then the whole thing changes again. And another setting configuration takes over. So you have lots of different or currents. Also, currents can also change very fast. They can speed up, they can slow down, they can change the course a little bit, stuff like this. And you have now ever more subsystems in Earth that are ever fasting, oscillating, or the variability of ever more subsystems starts to increase. And if you have subsystems like soil moisture over a large area of a continent that is very low, this means the coupling with the atmosphere is intensifying, supporting a massive high pressure system in this area because you have a low convective environment because you don't have any moisture for convection. So it supports the soil moisture as a subsystem, supports a high pressure system, other subsystem in an area, and both get interconnected. Then you get in this high pressure area intensifying, you get in the neighboring areas, you get a low pressure systems intensifying with high levels of rain amount. And also a large-scale moisture gradients, you have a large area with wet, like very wet soils and a large area of very dry soils intensifies the convection in the area where you have very moist soils. So these amplification processes between all these different influences, they start now to create a more efficient coupling between the system, the faraway systems also contributing to the intensity. For example, another example, we get no stratospheric warming events in the southern hemisphere. This means that the polar vortex collapses because it suddenly warms up and the stratospheric air goes downward and spills at the surface out of the Antarctic. But this whole event, it has ripple on effects affecting even the atmosphere near the Arctic. And what happens is this event is able to amplify single extreme events or to suppress it or to weaken them. But what we are concerned about is another kick of these events that are additional amplified by it. Like a heat wave, you get like, let's say, 45.6 degrees. Suddenly you have a stratospheric warming in the Antarctic and you get 48.2 degrees, another 0.3 degrees on top, but you have other processes like soil moisture or hot upper air from a flooding area also coming down in this area, all contributing to the heat waves reaching abnormal levels. And suddenly you have like Iraq heat wave again, reaching 50.1 degrees or something we have now there, or Iran. And on all these small additional contributions from other system changes, they lead to the single extreme events getting even a little bit more extreme, a little bit more extreme. And we get now this insane levels of events. And this is this non-linearity inside. The more systems that increase their variability, the more systems you have that contribute teleconnections, that strengthen systems or suppress systems. And sometimes you have extreme events where a lot of contributions happens that all add up to create a perfect storm. And suddenly you get a heat wave that is just insane from its intensity, which was not before possible because you did not have all these teleconnections contributing to a single event. And that's the problem. The whole system starts now to fluctuate more. And the more fluctuations you have of more systems, the higher the chance that single events create the perfect storms with lots of influences making the single event more extreme and more extreme. And that's the reason, the main reason we have now this increase in the most intense events, the most intense class of events, there we have the largest increases. And this is with this heat wave, this paper. The reason these heat waves are so much increasing is all these different components from the local to the planetary contributing to single events and pushing them over the edge. And the most important change we have now is ocean surface warming. It really speeded up in 23. And warmer ocean surfaces on a water planet, it's the main ingredient that you need for both flooding and heat waves. And that's highly worrying that the ocean surface temperature speeded now up. And that's also feedback reaction of Earth. And that's behind these intensifying heat waves. It's really crazy what happens in the Earth system now.
We will be right back with the conclusion of my conversation with German climate digger Cem Umsonst.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
What are we to make of the crazy weather this year? We will continue talking with Earth System nerd Jan Umsonst.
Yeah, I think one of the fundamental things that may be slowing down our ability to communicate this to the public, and even some scientists to understand it, is that the natural systems are a little bit more complex than we would ever think, but also that nature was not designed for the human mind to understand, or you could redesign that and say the human mind was not designed to understand all of nature. We cannot see changes in the atmosphere or in the depths of the ocean. We have to measure with various devices and put it together. We don't even really see the things we see coming in from the stars. All of those are colorized by NASA because they may actually be an image of radio waves or something beyond our senses. So I think that somehow, though, you and I and others have to get out the idea of teleconnections, of wave trains, of planetary waves. These are not something that most people understand, much less discuss in common speech, but it's something that's now going to lean on our lives in many ways. I mean, what are wave trains?
Actually, wave train is a jet stream that make it has a certain flow direction, that make waves. Yeah, and waves are, for example, affected by temperature and pressure differences in the direction of the jet stream. So if you get changing temperature and pressure differences along the way of the jet, it starts to make curves. It's called thermal wind balance. It's like one of the principles how the jet stream direction is calculated. But pressure differences in the way of the jet starts to influence its course. And it always goes, it follows, like if you have a more north-south pressure difference, it goes more straight. If you have a pressure difference that is more, or temperature difference that is more east-west, it goes more waviness, it gets more wavy. And what we observe now is that the pressure differences in the solar direction, east-west, warm, cold, and at the same latitude, they start to increase. So the waviness also starts to increase. And the waveguide is that if you have a disturbance in the jet, it's passed downward, the waviness of the jet. And the problem is if you get more disturbances in one place that grows in size and intensity, the waves are passed onward to in a flow direction. So you get more waves downstream if you have one disturbances. But if you disturbances along the jets are increasing, you get also more chaotic jets also. And so what we observe now, the jets are more and more disturbed by heat waves and flooding areas and low pressure systems that move north-southward or north-northward, or high pressure systems that persist in one place. So we get now all these chaotic effects, also like air that goes from north, cold air spills southward, or warm air reaches up to the Arctic because of blocking patterns. This is a stuck a high pressure system where wave makes a curve around it. So we get now all these air mass displacements, which also cause the jet to make more curves or to break up or to be deflected in the stratosphere, that creates now all this chaotic behavior that you get now, for example, in one area get a very persistent extreme, in the other area you get a fast exchange between wet and warmer, and suddenly hot and dry. So these shifts also intensify. So it's difficult to pin it down what is happening, but you get all terms of fluctuations and persistent systems. So and all has to do with the behavior also of the jet, but also with soil moisture and stuff like this. So wave train is for me something like the jet passes on disturbances, because the wave functions like a rope. If you swing the rope at one end, it makes this waves going downward. And this is like jet. But as the jet is now disturbed in ever more places, it gets also more erratic. And the other thing is with the jet is also if you have a decreasing north-south temperature differences, the wave, the jet can be disturbed more easily. So the jet is not only be disturbed more, it's also can be disturbed in its flow more easily, because the pressure differences in some sectors and in some time, in a week or something, are reduced. So so the whole thing gets now really chaotic. There was one study that was about quasi-resonant amplification of the jet. This is this waveguide also that is that the wave make that the jet makes 6 or 8 waves around the whole northern latitudes. And these kind of 6 to 8 wave configurations of the jet, they tripled the last decades. And this means you get in one area get this flooding where you have a trough, like a cold area in the atmosphere, you get this flooding. And where you have a ridge, where you have a hot area with a higher atmosphere, you get these extreme heat waves. So you have now more of these jet configurations, which create a circumpolar chain of extremes. Hot, cold, flooding, warm, dry, then again hot, flood, warm, dry. So we get now circumhemisphere synchronization of extreme events. It's also another thing what happens there. All is related also to the jet, but also how the jet is the coupling between the surface and the jet is also intensifying. This means Not only pressure differences in the atmosphere play a role in modulating the jet stream, but also surface extreme. If you get a massive marine heat wave, it creates a higher atmosphere, but also it supports a low convective environment, which supports a high pressure system. And this high pressure system hold in place leads to the jet going northward of the high pressure system. So these marine heat waves also act now more and more like wave guides, which lead to persistent pattern in the jet in one area, which leads downstream to extremes in certain areas. So these knock-on effects also increase, and the whole thing gets now really chaotic.
Well, what are you hoping to do? And do you get out in places other than Facebook? How do you pass on your science knowledge?
Actually, I'm not very good at writing Finnish texts. The largest text I wrote was 2,000 pages about the oceans with thousands of studies, but I did not finish it. But then I know microbiology of the oceans, since then I know. Actually, I have my channels, and I try to write more longer texts, some in-depth investigations of a change or how to connect things. But actually, I'm very averse. I'm distributing my knowledge, but also it's, writing is the best method, actually. Then you can organize your thoughts and can structurize the thing. But I don't know, actually. I hope that our species will understand that we are heading for bad, bad times. That's my hope.
Well, if we had that realization, perhaps we would avoid the very worst times and extinction. That's my hope. And I think that we will. I'm not a total doomer. I see how people have survived leaping off burning ships and things like that. We're a very tough species. Some of us will go on, but our current way of doing things cannot go on. It will self-destroy.
I'm not a doomer. I'm a realist, actually. And realistic speaking, we are heading for an extinction level event. But we can reverse it. If humanity frees its potential because emission reduction, the times are over, we need our full potential to reverse what is happening in the Earth system, because we trigger likely a self-reinforcing global warming, which will go out of our hands, even if we go down to zero emissions. And to reverse that, we will need to draw out greenhouse gases as fast, as much as we can do it. And so I hope that this intensification of extreme events, which will go now much faster, that cannot be anymore ignored, that it will lead to realization of our species, that we have to act as a species, and that otherwise we will fail as a species. This is it's not anymore able to mitigate or to adapt to. Mitigate, yes, but we cannot adapt to what's coming at us. Like China, they will have to change the whole water control system. They have to rebuild every dam and all these reservoirs, because the rain amounts will just go insane levels. And so it just shows us that we will not be able to adapt. So maybe we will realize that we will have to reverse what our water planet is now starting to kick off, hopefully. And so I came to the realization, doesn't matter what I write, doesn't matter what I do, the people have to realize it through their own experiences. And hopefully our species will understand it. So this is for me also the reason it doesn't matter what I would write, what I would try to communicate, you reach some people, but it's a question of our species, and it's too waste. So hopefully people will understand.
All right. I think we're going to have to wrap it up there, but I would like to talk to you again. This is great.
I mean, I'm not inside this definition thing. I'm not interested in definitions. I'm interested in actually what moves the jet. And now we find out it's not only the atmosphere and pressure differences and temperature differences, but it's also surface extremes that modulate the jet stream flow direction. So it's interacting. And this was before not the case. Before you could calculate the jet's direction just by thermal wind balance and pressure differences. But now they realize it's not really fitting anymore. It seems like the surface extremes play a role also now. It's really interesting to watch science to find new aspects of things they are studying since decades. but the atmosphere physicians, they could not see it before because the coupling is just starting to lift off, and now they can see it happening, how this intensification processes work. And before, they were not apparent, they were not visible. And just now they can observe it, and now they can make a theory around it. So actually our whole theory of atmosphere physics is around a system with a lower energy level. Now we get atmosphere with a higher energy level, so we need different physics. And it's also highly interesting what's happening there.
That was Earth System nerd Jan Umsonst in an unscripted interview by Zoom July 31st, 2025. Find more notes and quotes and links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. I hope to have Jan back in the fall as we try to find out why and how climate threats accelerate as we modify the atmosphere. Stay tuned. Jan began by saying it is a very bad idea to heat up a water planet. A new study released July 24th reports marine heat waves covered 96% of the oceans in 2023, lasted four times longer than average. Right now, there is a vast marine heat wave in the North Pacific Ocean. No doubt that is twisting weather out of shape downstream in the atmosphere, which, due to the direction Earth turns, is North America. Weather systems and atmospheric pressure patterns often originate over the North Pacific and then propagate eastward, impacting weather over North America. This is not an El Niño. Although it is still early for such a projection, it appears we are headed into another weak La Niña season. So it's not that. It is just straight up too much energy, trapped by our greenhouse gas emissions, landing in the huge Pacific Ocean and feeding back into our unstable weather.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
David Spratt is a climate policy analyst in Australia and research director at the Breakthrough National Center for Climate Restoration. He is known for his book and website called Climate Code Red. David has been on Radio EcoShock a couple of times. In a recent interview with Nick Breeze of ClimateGen, Spratt says the widespread idea that 1.5 degrees of warming is some kind of safe resting point is proven absurd by recent events. Earth has already reached 1.5C degree of warming about 16 years ahead of predictions. Are we safe? I am not. Nobody is. Spratt points to James Hansen's position that 1.5 degrees C of warming is a point of instability. Nothing rests there. Either it keeps on getting hotter, or humans somehow help it get cooler, or a miracle happens. David says either cool back to 1 degree or right back to pre-industrial carbon levels, with geoengineering of some sort if we must, or we go to 3 degrees, where very little survives.
Degrees is not a point of system stability, and the reason for that is obvious, and it's before our eyes right now, and that is that so many carbon cycles are now out of sync, and whether it's forest, whether it's permafrost, whether it's boreal forest, whether it's retreating ice sheets changing the reflectivity of the planet, 1.52 is not a point of system stability. Either going to end up at 3, or you're going to have to cool back to 0.
David is a longtime climate activist, and he's now loudly calling for immediate experiments in cooling with sulfates, that is, geoengineering. Host Nick Breeze in the UK raises a concern that geoengineering might cause an unforeseen backlash in climate affairs, including icing over his own country. This is a conversation you should hear.
Potentially going to keep going to a degree, a whole degree of overshoot. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of dialogue. I know that there's a tipping points conference going on, and we just had the Arctic Repair Conference that I attended. And the people talking about the AMOC, the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, the ocean currents that transport heat around and keep the world as we know it climatically, that's potentially slowing down and stopping, which would transform global climate. And yet, when they analyze the impacts of climate intervention, so if you did stratospheric aerosol injection, for example, so you pump stuff up to try and cool down, you really got to start 5 years ago because of the whole processes involved. I couldn't repeat the science to you, but as you go further down this road and closer to it tipping, if it actually tips, the recent research seems to indicate if you tried to cool then, you could actually cause a massive advance of ice sheets down to southern England.
Yeah.
Now, there's loads of stuff around that.
I think there are two issues there. First of all, coming back to this question of overshoots and getting in too late, there's this thing which I won't try and explain in detail called hysteresis, which basically says the path from A to B is not the same path from B back to A. That is, for example, if you melt an ice sheet or slow down an AMOC, that can happen really quickly in 100, 200 years, very quickly in historical terms. But the path back is really slow. I remember talking to our Antarctic scientists saying, we think that the tipping point for the really vulnerable Antarctic glaciers was around 0.5 to 0.8 of a degree, looking back. But they said you might have to get back to zero to refreeze it. So this idea of overshoot and being able to just, you know, open the blind and everything will be all right again, this is a problem. Overshoot because of hysteresis and other things makes it a very complicated question. And the second issue you refer to is something that I think Mike McCracken, I don't know whether he talked about in your recent interview with him, he said there's this view that climate interventions, sulfate, you know, cooling the planet is something that we'll do when everything else has failed. You know, when we've got to 2.5 or 3 degrees. But he said at 2.5 or 3 degrees, it probably won't work because the problem is too big. He said you need to start testing this early. He says at 1, 1.5 degrees, it might work. At 2.5 or 3, it won't. And that's the issue. And I think that's parallel to the AMOC story that you were telling, that waiting things get bad and thinking some magic bullet will reverse it is not going to happen.
Is it time for desperate measures? Personally, I don't think we know enough to mess with nature, and I wouldn't want to see geoengineering go ahead while we continue to invest and expand fossil fuels. We can't keep fossil fuels and engineer the climate at tremendous risk. We don't even know what would happen. But David thinks we have no time left to wait. You can find the Spratt interview with Nick Breeze on YouTube or at gen.cc, that's GENN.cc. Of course, there's also a link in my blog. The YouTube interview is titled, At the Point of Systemic Collapse, What is the Least Worst Outcome? It is late, and I have to assess our situation and get ready. Tomorrow may be smoke, fire, or flood here in the climate casino. Many experts have been warning this would come for decades. As Canada burns right now, as Spain and Greece burned, and Australia and certainly Russia, Radio EcoShock broadcast The New Age of Superfire back in July 2016.
Nobody ever lived like this. Heat in winter, flood all of a sudden. Winds are wilder, here we go.
For those of you fearing floods from the northeast of North America all the way to Beijing, we have at least a half dozen programs on the whys and wherefores of expanding flood threats as the planet warms. 2 weeks ago, I just covered the deadly floods in Kerrville, Texas, in New Mexico, Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and Chicago. I played an interview with UCLA expert Jesse Norris about extreme rainfall events. That was recorded in September 2021. Get the full show with links in my blog, all free, of course. No sign-ups, just science direct from the authors. I mean, nothing pops up on you. I don't want your email address. I don't want you to sign up for anything. just grab the science and spread it out as far as you can. How about my new show, Global Super Rain, The New Face of Climate Change? We talked with expert Jonathan Gourley from the NOAA National Severe Storms Laboratory. Will that even continue to exist? That was in 2023, but it could have been today. Here's a quick sample from that interview with some tips on how to stay alive during a flash flood event.
Radio EcoShock.
From Norman, Oklahoma, Jonathan Gourley, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Thanks for having me.
I can't keep track of all the bizarre extreme rainfalls and flash floods this month alone. What do you think is going on?
Well, I think what you're seeing is the result of extreme heating that we've been experiencing, because if you look at the global temperatures, we've been setting monthly records. So if we look at the theory of that, then what happens with warmer oceans, then you add more fuel to these tropical storms and hurricanes. And then the part that I work on is more the inland flash flooding, and that's less impacted by the warmer oceans, but everything's connected in the Earth system, of course. And so what I study is more of the, let's say, the land surface impacts that we get from warming and what that results in terms of rainfall. So with increased temperatures, then what we have is much greater potential for heavy rainfall, since the atmosphere can hold much more water vapor in it, warmer temperatures, then it has the capability to transport that increased water vapor over land surfaces. And then what we get with that is the potential for much heavier rainfall. And that's what we've been seeing in the last couple months.
Well, still puzzling to me, why does a long drought so often end not with a gentle transition to wetter weather, but a breakout of hard rain and instant floods? Have you noticed that pattern, and what could explain that?
Yeah, sure. Well, what you're referring to is called these kind of whiplash events. It's been observed in maybe just the past couple of years. It's kind of a new line of research. And what you see is these, what we call pluvials, or these kind of rainfall periods where it's anomalously wet. So after we get these pluvial events, when it's anomalously wet, then a lot of times you see these situations where it shuts off and becomes dry all of a sudden and remains that way. And many researchers have coined that term a flash drought. And so we're seeing that more frequently now in today's climate, which is projected to become more extreme as we move forward under the similar emissions if we continue in this way.
Are those deaths increasing, or are we handling them better?
Yeah, to look at the long-term trends of flash flood fatalities, it's a not extreme uptick in that amount. That's not an area that I've researched too heavily on those trends. But what we do find with those fatalities and circumstances surrounding the fatalities, that a vast majority of them are in what I would call a dynamic situation in terms of the vulnerability. And what I mean by that is it typically occurs when people are out and about. Rarely does a flash flood come to you and disturb you in your home. Tornadoes will do that. But flash floods become deadly whenever people are driving into them. That's what occurs about 60% of the time. And then the second leading cause is, again, people that are out and about. They're in a environment that's familiar to them, like in their neighborhood. And they may be out checking on a drain that's plugged up. Then they may clear the drain, and then they get into trouble, or even people that are recreating in floodwaters, which is a very hazardous thing to do. And then we find that the third most leading cause of flash flood fatalities are, again, people outside in an unfamiliar environment. So this would be people that are camping next to a river in a popular spot. Maybe they're hiking in a slot canyon. And so these are factors that get people into trouble.
That was Jonathan Gourley from the NOAA National Severe Storms Lab on Radio EcoShock, September 20th, 2023. Get the full interview with the link in my show blog. Well, it's been a busy week for many of you and for me, and that's a busy show. I hope you will continue to follow up with more on how climate change will affect our lives, and consider whether it's time for drastic action. I don't know. It's up to you.
I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening. This is Radio EcoShock.
The new sun sees.